Welcome to Symptomatic Redness, a podcast for those who are pathologically interested in history, critical theory, philosophy, aesthetics, or anything that may inform the modern world.
Today we will be interviewing Chris Catrone of the Platypus Affiliated Society with guest co-interviewer Lexi Kay of Emancipation and Swampside Chats. This is part one of a three-part discussion. To hear the complete discussion, please subscribe to our Patreon feed at Zero Books.
Welcome to Symptomatic Redness. Today we are doing a joint hostile interview, as requested, with Lexi Kay of Swampside Chats and Emancipation Con Network Podcast. What is it now, yeah. Lexi?
We're still working out the role for the podcast, but we do have the Emancipation Network, podcast multimedia network. So neat.
And me, C. Derek Varn of Systematic Redness. And we're here today with Chris Catrone of the Platypus Affiliated Society. Chris, what roles do you currently have in the organization?
Well, I am the chief pedagogue, meaning I advise all the reading groups that Platypus is doing.
So you kind of oversee the reading groups and the syllabi and reading list, etc. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And you are a founding member, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. For full disclosure, I was a fellow traveler of Platypus Affiliated Society from 2011 to 2012, and then from 2012 to 2013, a member of the Soul Chapter. But Chris and I have actually never met each other, so.
Right.
All right. Lexi, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I have no similar past with the Platypus Affiliated Society to disclose. Although, you know, Platypus was one of the groups, one of the few groups that bothered to continue to produce theory and organize, not just despite, but on the basis of the sort of post-left moment and the theories of, you know, sociological or whatever, or historical pessimism around the contemporary left. And yeah, the only one that, especially the only one that's, that to my knowledge, that's doing it on the grounds of some kind of Spartacist heritage, some quote Orthodox Trotskyist heritage. And so between the sort of Adorno to Postone kind of trend in political theory, the one that eludes the whole Althusserian turn, which I think that's the right strand of critical theory if you're going to run with one, and that sort of like post-left nausea, the Sparts as an influence is something that stands out kind of jarringly. And the two seem to be in very direct tension. So I guess I'd start off by, you know, how does one reconcile not just the Spartacists, but the general, I guess the general like turn towards and respect for liberalism with the Frankfurt School and, you know, the analysis that ends up playing out as a dialectic of enlightenment to the kind of post-owned point where the whole goddamn project of Marxism is ends up becoming implicated necessarily.
I think that, you know, in terms of my own background, I already considered myself a Marxist before I met the Spartacist League in college. Mm-hmm. And I think that before I met them, I had sort of respect for the Russian Revolution, for Lenin and Trotsky, but I didn't know all that much about them. And I didn't really delve into it all that deeply. And the way that I would put, you know, my education, what I learned from the Spartacists, is that they really opened my eyes to the early history of Marxism, the sort of pre-1917, pre-Russian Revolution Marxism. And so I'd consider myself a Marxist on the basis of reading Marx and Engels, and also a little bit of Ernest Mandel, a book of his, Revolutionary Marxism Today, just happened to be on the shelf of my local library growing up in my hometown. I'm not sure why they bought that book. So I was exposed to Trotskyism to a certain degree, but I didn't really recognize it all that much as such. So for me, you know, the orthodoxy of the Spartacist League just means taking the earlier history of Marxism seriously and as a challenge. In other words, not simply as a dogmatic script, but as a challenge to live up to. And that was before I ever read Adorno or the Frankfurt School. And Adorno and the Frankfurt School made a lot of sense to me based on that education that I got from the Spartacist League, meaning I could read between the lines of Adorno and the rest of the Frankfurt School and see what they were taking for granted. And so their work made sense in a particular way, which is obviously very different from the way the Frankfurt School is usually received. Now, you said something about liberalism. Spartacists are kind of, I would say, notorious for their defense of liberalism as well. It's, being opposed to age of consent laws or defending Bernard Goetz's right to defend himself in the New York City subway shooting. You know, they've had controversial positions that are precisely on the basis of what most people would consider to be a liberal bourgeois democratic rights perspective. And certainly the Frankfurt School also, despite, you know, what they thought had happened to liberalism in the era of capitalism, especially in advanced capitalism, it's succumbing to authoritarianism and the administrative state. They also held to that tradition, the tradition of classical liberalism, what have you. And, you know, of course, neither the Spartacists nor the Frankfurt School are alone in that. Anarchists, whether in the Chomsky tradition or in the Murray Bookchin tradition, also hold to that same set of principles. In that respect, the Spartacists would denounce the Frankfurt School as liberal, as merely liberal. I'm not sure that the reverse would be true. In other words, I don't think that the Frankfurt School's critique of what happened to Marxism in the 20th century is a critique of its implicit liberalism or something like that. I think that their kind of notion that liberalism gave rise to fascism, you know, it's obviously mediated. It's not direct. And I guess we'd have to, you know, distinguish between the Enlightenment and liberalism as well, because the Enlightenment is a more complex and broader phenomenon than the revolutionary tradition.
So those are pretty fair points. And I think, like most Marxists who were educated in historical Marxism, wouldn't reject them. But one tension that was noted and that Platypus as a group has been tarred with is a different stance on imperialism than is common on the, quote, left in general, unquote, and also from the Spartacist League. So What is the distinction there?
Well, I guess I could start with an anecdote. I spoke on an Adorno panel, an academic conference in Europe, in Amsterdam, a couple of years ago, and alongside a younger scholar who said that he was shocked, a German scholar of the Frankfurt School, who said that he was shocked to discover that the Frankfurt School's critique of the administrative state was based on Lenin's critique of imperialism. So the first thing that I would say is one would have to distinguish between imperialism and colonialism. And I think that it's a new left and really Stalinist, goes back to the 30s and in some respects to the 20s, this elision of the difference between colonialism and imperialism, that those terms are used interchangeably. So one thing that I would say straight away is how one understands cause and effect. So I think that in a new left and in a Stalinist, but also in a liberal way, the imperial state is seen as the product of colonialism. So the imperial state at home is seen as the corruption of the state by colonialism, which then brings its authoritarianism back home, something like that, like an Aimé Césaire critique, which is to say that, you know, fascism and World War I and World War II were the visiting upon Europe of what Europe had visited upon the colonies. I think that Marxism, going back to Marx and Engels and to people like Lenin, you know, Lenin and Luxembourg and Trotsky, that their understanding is quite the opposite, which is to say that the kind of late colonialism that you see in the capitalist era in the 19th century is actually an extension of the imperial state that develops out of capitalism in the metropoles. So one has to, think about how the basis of one's anti-imperialism. So for instance, Eugene Debs, who was a good Marxist, leader in the Socialist Party of America, he gave a famous speech when he accepted the nomination of the Socialist Party for President of the United States in 1900 on competition versus cooperation, actually a speech given here in Chicago, at their convention here in Chicago in 1900, in which he said that the Democrats, William Jennings Bryan in that election, opposed imperialism from the standpoint of the middle class that was being destroyed by capitalism. And he distinguished the socialist opposition to imperialism from that kind of conservative, reactionary, small capitalist opposition to imperialism. For example, so he said, well, of course, socialists are against all the depredations of capitalism in the colonies, but not because we're against big capital. And we understand that the depredations in the colonies is a necessary result. It's not an accident or a mistake. It's not a moral failing. It's a necessary result of the concentration of capital and the imperial state that arises from the concentration of capital. So, you know, again, most anti-imperialism, most anti-colonialism is of a kind of petty bourgeois democratic variety, whether in the metropole or in the periphery. And Marxism always distinguished itself from that, right? So Deb said, we don't want to break up imperialism. We want the working class to take over capitalism, which is very different. And he analogized it to the monopolies. So William Jennings Bryan and the Democrats, who were the conservatives at the time, as opposed to the Republicans simply celebrated the triumphs of capitalism. The Democrats bemoaned the destruction of the middle class by capitalism. And the socialists did not want to break up the monopolies. It didn't want to break up imperial capital, but wanted the working class to take it over, which is very different. So usually what happens is cause and effect are reversed. So, you know, obviously on the left, people think that the U.S. invades countries because Americans are racist or something. And that's not the way Marxists understand these things. A right-wing critique of imperialism would have to be distinguished from a left-wing critique of imperialism. And most anti-imperialism, if not all, starting in the 20th century and up till today, is a right-wing critique of imperialism.
What degree of autonomy for formerly like colonized peoples do you think is acceptable within a Marxist bounds? Because in addition to kind of not taking, you know, the Leninist turn with regards to imperialism, we could talk about Leninism more generally later, as this is a hostile interview. From what I understand, there was some sort of, and again, this is hearsay, I'm sure you can clarify it. Mm-hmm. There's a report of some internal conversation to Platypus about Israel and Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. And about the superiority of capitalism as a mode of production to previous modes of production, supposedly in a comment that you made. And how it would be a good thing if capitalism replaced this, but it also seemed by extension, you know, whatever traditional kind of modes of production or social structures are left, you know, and not that there's many pockets of this in the world, but let's say the Sentinelese, you know.
all right, right, so that would be different from Palestine, though, right?
No, of course, but like the comments that you made have a universal character for them that would imply something that, again, mirrors this tendency in Marxism to come down with the dialectic of enlightenment that I think is firmly expressed in Leninism, firmly expressed in the drive towards proletarianization under the socialist state.
I would distinguish a couple of things. Let me just say that bourgeoisification, like bourgeois emancipation, the emancipation of labor, the revolt of the third estate, is not the same thing as proletarianization. And this is a kind of a classic thing from Luxembourg, Lenin, and Trotsky, their disputes with other Russian Marxists, legal Marxists, for example, who thought that the industrialization of Russia would lead to Russia's democratization and liberalization. And they pointed out that, of course, this isn't true. In other words, what it did was it turned the old feudal aristocratic czarist state into a modern capitalist Bonapartist state. So again, the idea that there would be this sort of evolution, progressive emancipatory evolution of society through industrialization, they attack that. And I agree with that. In other words, that would be an undialectical view. It would also be an undialectical view, however, to have the kind of Narodnik and socialist revolutionary view, which would treat capitalism as a kind of foreign penetration, right? A kind of subverting of the traditional peasant commune that could be the basis, a better basis for socialism, in their view. And Luxembourg wrote her dissertation on the development of capitalism in Poland, and Lenin wrote his dissertation on the development of capitalism in Russia to show that this Narodnik understanding of resisting the foreign penetration of capital was hopeless because, in fact, capitalism had already penetrated. So again, neither a sort of resistance to capitalism nor a celebration of capitalism as some kind of progress in freedom is warranted. Mm-hmm. Now, on Israel-Palestine, it's something else entirely. In other words, there are all sorts of analogies that people bring to that question. Since you raised the Spartacists, Spartacists, of course, have the position of the Middle East being a condition of interpenetrated peoples. And so their position was for a binational state in a socialist federation of the Middle East, right? So the one state solution, we might say, right, as opposed to this two state solution. They were against the two state solution because they saw the betrayal of the Palestinian masses by Palestinian nationalism, and also by more broadly Arab nationalism. Now, of course, Arab nationalism and Palestinian nationalism went bankrupt politically, which is what gave rise to Islamism, Hamas, right? So a lot of the left supported Hamas against the PLO, against the so-called PLO corruption, precisely for this reason, recognizing that Palestinian nationalism was not an adequate expression of the self-determination of the Palestinian people against the national oppression by the Zionist state. Okay, so how do we understand Israel-Palestine? People talk about it as settler colonialism. They talk about it as apartheid, which are actually two different things, even though they're related. So it's analogized with South Africa and the occupied territories, and what would become a Palestinian state is usually criticized by the left as a kind of Bantustan, right? The kind of Bantustan model, that the kind of self-determination that is going to be offered to Palestinians is going to be not really self-determination at all. I would also point out, because of my background with South African Solidarity, that, of course, there were black nationalists in South Africa who supported the apartheid state against the ANC and the communists. So, for instance, the Zulus, right? In other words, there were blacks who were in a position of power in apartheid who were part of the violent suppression of the ANC and the Communist Party there, right? So that happens. Also, the left, the socialist left in Israel-Palestine has not only been suppressed by the Zionist state, but also by the Palestinian traditional ruling classes and Palestinian nationalism. So it's fairly complicated, but again, the question is, how does one approach the problem of the oppression of the Palestinian people from a leftist, from a socialist or Marxist perspective? Because most responses to that situation are not Marxist at all. They're liberal, they're nationalist, Islamist, but really there's no Marxism that's brought to bear there. Spartacists, however, at least historically, and I guess nominally up to the present, have had a more traditional Marxist approach, which is to say that in a situation of interpenetrated peoples, it's not about ethnic cleansing or driving the Palestinians out of the occupied territories, or conversely driving the Hebrew-speaking peoples into the sea, right? That neither of those would be good, and neither of those would have anything to do with socialism, but rather that with interpenetrated peoples, you would need at least a binational state, and really you would need a federation of the Middle East there are all sorts of peoples. There's the Druze, there are the Bedouins, right? So there are Muslims, there are Arabs who are fierce supporters of Israel because they recognize that the Palestinian nationalists and also the Islamists would oppress them if they had their way, right? So all of that is real. And, you know, it's related to other things like Lebanon as a multi-ethnic state, as a multi-religious, multi-communal state. You know, there are Palestinians living in refugee camps throughout the Middle East, and they're not treated particularly well in those states outside of Israel. So socialists would be concerned about the interrelationship of all of those things.
Okay. Yes. But I guess this may get to what you mean by Marxism. And maybe you can spell that out a little more. But you're not obviously not using the term nominalistically. In much the way that, you know, Platypus uses the left as, you know, a Platonic marker. I don't mean that negatively. I think there's utility in sometimes doing this when you're trying
aspirationally to use a term, right? It's an aspiration. Right. It's like the Green New Deal. It's not meant literally, it's meant aspirationally.
Right. I think there is just an element of this that ignores why Marxism nominally took the turn towards nationalism that it did. And without endorsing it, that this tradition in Marxism that does have, you know, there are forms of it that are like anti-imperialist in a good way, that there's something that doesn't quite embrace the challenge of dealing with a fundamentally capitalist nation state order that nonetheless offers a kind of autonomy, right? Maybe an autonomy that Marxists will find ultimately empty because it's form determined, but a level of autonomy that this socialist vision does not, you know. It's not, how do I put this? I hesitate to say it's not rhizomatic enough, but it doesn't allow for
bring some class terms into it, which is to say, you know, if one were to be strictly Leninist in the sense of Lenin, he's for the self-determination of the working class. In other words, autonomy, self-determination for whom, right? It certainly isn't for some national bourgeoisie or capitalist class. Like, that was not what Lenin supported. No,
but Lenin thinks that he's got a way around organizing nations, you know, in a way that doesn't just end up being a national bourgeoisie. So Lenin is a particularly contradictory figure here.
Well, I think that we can clear it up, actually, pretty straightforwardly, which is to say that he thought that the working class should champion the struggle against national oppression, even the national oppression of bourgeois or capitalist elements, but that the working class should be so organized as to be able to take a leading role in championing the right of national self-determination against national oppression, right? It's always in those terms. It's always championing self-determination against the oppression of nations, including those members of the nation who are privileged. He just thought that the working class ought to take the leading role in that. Right. So, of course, that doesn't mean that one doesn't care about, you know, the national oppression of a wealthy Palestinian, or for that matter, doesn't care about the sexist oppression of a wealthy woman. Right. But the point is to organize the working class as the leading political force to champion that struggle. And that really underpins his whole perspective, because without that, it becomes something entirely different. Then it does become nationalism. It becomes a kind of Marxist rationalization for nationalism, as opposed to a setting of a task of what the working class must do in its struggle for socialism. So without a working class that's organized to champion these struggles, what one does is put a Marxist rationalization on what other people are doing politically, namely petty bourgeois Democrats, nationalists, etc.
Okay. I suppose that one thing that comes to mind to me is that when people hear this explanation, they're going to be hard-pressed to understand your position on post-neoliberalism and Trump. Would you like to go into that a little bit? How does this relate to your kind of agnostic stance on that?
I would just say, you know, straight away that I'm mostly concerned with you know, as I guess I've been ever since I reemerged into political public life, so-called political, but really just public life, meaning I spent more than 10 years just avoiding all this stuff and staying out of the public sphere, you know, having my opinions, but staying out of the public sphere. So since Platypus, I've re-engaged, you know, my students kind of summoned me to this role that I had otherwise shied away from. And what I've taken upon myself in that public role is to attack lies. So, for instance, the idea that the Iraqi resistance to the U.S. and other countries' intervention in Iraq, invasion and occupation of Iraq, that the celebration of the so-called Iraqi resistance was not an authentic championing of self-determination for the peoples of Iraq against imperialism, right? It was just a sort of anti-U.S., which is very different kind of approach. So they had to, you know, call the former Baathists or the Sunni resistance or the Shia resistance something that it wasn't. In other words, these were, it turned out, you know, I was right. They were just using military force to jockey for position in the settlement, right? In other words, they were just, and which the left saw that, and they thought that it was due to the U.S. dividing and conquering, as opposed to what really happened, which is that the collapse of the Iraqi state just unleashed a communalist civil war that the Baathists had kept barely in check all those years. So it wasn't the U.S. dividing and conquering. It was rather these people started attacking each other and tried to jockey for position, sometimes turning against the U.S., sometimes working with the U.S. And the left called it a kind of national liberation struggle, which it wasn't. Meaning, you know, I was, like everyone else, you know, I'm a leftist. I was opposed to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and I was opposed to the occupation of Iraq, of course. However, that doesn't mean that you have to call the people on the ground something that they aren't. So I started out my kind of public political life around the formation of Platypus, fighting against those kinds of misrepresentations, similarly with Trump and, you know, with post-neoliberalism. Trump's not he's not a nationalist, even if he calls himself a nationalist. There's a way in which he can't be, right? So he's sort of structurally prevented from being, and also his understanding of what he's doing doesn't really conform with nationalism.
So first of all, your analysis of the Iraq War, you have in common with Moshe Pistone, and I think it would actually comport with some Leninist understandings, like Samir Amin, for instance.
Of course,
had a very similar read of Baathism. But in regards to Trump not being a nationalist, and I don't exactly have the Andrew Klein response, pardon my French, the sort of response with regards to Trump as
fascist.
As a fascist. Yeah, I'm not particularly, you know, prone to this. However, I do think it's possible to, you know, bend the stick a bit too far. And I'm curious, Trump isn't a nationalist because he's structurally prevented from being one. Is it impossible to be a nationalist?
No. A couple of things. So let me unpack that because I realize that's a kind of a clogged statement. One has to do with the United States. In other words, the United States is not a normal nation state, either historically nor in the role that it plays today. And nationalism in the United States would have to take, you know, I think there was a brief moment when people were thinking about what American fascism might have to look like, that it would have to be like multiracial fascism, for example. But let's stick with the white nationalist perspective, which is to say that if there were going to be a nationalism in the United States, it would have to be a kind of white nationalism. It would have to be a kind of Anglo-white nationalism. Well, of course, the Republican Party, the American political system, the vehicles by which Trump came to power are not based on any such thing. And so therefore, you know, even if he wanted to be a nationalist, he wouldn't be able to be without not changing the state so much, but at least changing his political environment. I don't think, for instance, that Bannon is the author of Trump. Right? Trump's been saying the same thing for 30 years. And Bannon was a Tea Partier, he was a supporter of Ted Cruz, and he has his own idiosyncratic ideology. So Bannon tried to jump on the Trump bandwagon and was ultimately dropped from it. Trump was not the creature of Steve Bannon. And even Bannon is not really a white nationalist. He's more a Catholic reactionary and a kind of ecumenical nationalist in that sense, meaning he wants to create something that's never really existed in the United States, which is a kind of an American nationalism that would include, you know, Black people, for example, very prominently. You guys know that Steve Bannon decorates his house in D.C. as if it were in 1865 with a lot of like vintage furniture and Lenin memorabilia. I mean, not Lenin, Lincoln. Lincoln memorabilia. And it's all very bizarre. But again, he has a project that, you know, Trump's just not so extreme. He's not so ideological. The way that I like to put it is that Trump doesn't want to return to the 1950s or something like that. He wants to return to the 1990s. In other words, when he was a Democrat mm-hmm. and when he was a friend of the Clintons, he wants to go back to the New World Order and untroubled, you know, neoliberal U.S. hegemony in the world. He just thinks that the two parties kind of fucked it up.
So if he's interested in a neoliberal world order, what do you make of him sort of being a pivotal figure in reintroducing sanctions to the sort of like big trade vocabulary? It's one thing to put sanctions on Cuba or right. or a rogue state. It's another to put it on a trade partner. What about that?
Fair trade versus free trade. So I guess one way that he was always a dissident, like he definitely, you know, if you look at what he said about the elections in 92, for example, and how he got involved with the Ross Perot's party. So on the one hand, he was anti-NAFTA from the beginning. So was Clinton, but then decided to be pro-NAFTA. Right. And Trump kind of hedged on that. He said, well, okay, it seems like, you know, so he felt that there was a betrayal involved in Clinton signing on to NAFTA that had been negotiated by George Herbert Walker Bush. And so he's always been anti-NAFTA, but at the same time, against it in what way, right? Against it in the sense that he thought the U.S. should have negotiated a stronger position for itself in it. In other words, he wasn't against it per se. He was just against the terms, right? He wasn't against it in principle. He was against its execution. That's been his shtick. His shtick is that, you know, actually he agrees with everything that the Republicans and Democrats claim to want. He just thinks that they're poor on execution, right? That they botched the negotiations. And, you know, he's going to roll out, you know, he'll be in Vietnam meeting with Kim Jong-un and he'll roll out a trade deal with China shortly. And what one will discover is that it's a fairly minor renegotiation of terms, right? So he's using, you know, tariffs and he's using these devices. And he wrote about this in his book. So, you know, when he started running for president, I burdened myself with investigating, okay, what is this about? Because I didn't, you know, I would never have thought, like, Donald Trump, like, what are you kidding me? Like, you know, I'm from New York, so it's like, you know, it's a little bit of a joke.
Right, of course.
Right? And so it's like, okay, well, but what is this really about? And, you know, he said the president, the United States president has certain powers that allow him or her to overcome bipartisan gridlock in Congress, that allow him to act on a world stage more or less unilaterally. And so he had a definite idea of what could be done as president in the things that he cares about. And the number one thing he cares about is trade. And there he just feels like the U.S. has consistently negotiated bad deals through kind of a poor execution.
Right.
So he doesn't think, oh, well, sold out to the global elites. Like, he's not like an anti-globalist like that, right? Like, he doesn't have that whole ideological thing going on. He just thinks that they botched it.
Okay. But the kind of horizons for trade are historically, I don't know, the dominant strategy the United States has taken is to enter into some production.
Multilateral.
Yeah, these multilateral trade agreements and some of these, like, I don't want to put the manner too sharply, but they've sacrificed some of their market power as hegemon for political influence often.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And so Trump is acting as a nationalist insofar as he applies the art of the deal to getting the U.S. a better deal.
That's a hard bargain.
That's a turn in U.S. policy that I think, because the U.S. is this global entity, basically, it's not just, you know, its extension far outstrips its territory. That, you know, that doesn't mean that there isn't, one isn't, I don't know, one isn't capable of nationalism. I think, I understand where you're going here. He's not a classical nationalist.
He's not a retreat into isolationism, for example, right? Because the U.S. can't really do that. Like, structurally, like, the world needs the U.S. to act the way it does. In other words, not only does the U.S. foster so-called competitors, but also those competitors, even the ones on the outer limits of the world order, like Russia or China, even Iran, you know, and North Korea, for Christ's sake, they all participate in the global world order. And the problems that, like, a country like Russia has with the United States have more to do with the U.S. interfering in their regional environment. They're not opposed to the U.S. playing the role that it plays on a global scale, but they definitely want the U.S. not to interfere. So let me say something about, because in my Why Not Trump article, I put a few things in there for a reason, which is to say, one already saw before the 2016 election that global trade was drying up, that there was a massive slowdown of global trade as the Great Recession had rolled on. And that ultimately, though China had been insulated against the effects of the Great Recession, ultimately the effects of the Great Recession caught up with China. And if you listen to Trump, he will say that now's the time for the U.S. to strike a better deal with China, precisely because of the advantage that the U.S. has over China, because of the way the Chinese economy is vulnerable to the slowdown at a global level. And he claims, he says, that a better, a more equitable trade balance between the U.S. and China will ensure Chinese growth in the future. In other words, he has an Adam Smith perspective, which is, you know, charmingly naive. But however, right, he's not alone in that. You know, a lot of people have this kind of notion, the tide that will raise all boats. And I think he sincerely believes it. He also, you know, for instance, thinks that though Mexico exported a lot of its problems to the United States under a bad deal, that a relatively minor, like a slight, not a massive change in trade policy between the U.S. and Mexico, and also including Canada, would be beneficial for both the United States and Mexico, whereas before, the botched deal was detrimental to both the U.S. and Mexico, right? So one has to take this seriously, because even though Trump is whatever he is, you know, he's the big orange monster, people who would not elicit such a strong aesthetic response say the exact same thing that Trump does, and would never be accused of being a white nationalist or whatever. Right? In other words, you can find discourse along these lines in, you know, mainstream economics debates.
No, of course. I don't have a problem with identifying that. But on the contrary, wouldn't you say that it's just the structure of things that makes Trump not be able to be as much of a nationalist as he is in terms of his point of view?
Well, it depends on, you know, what you want, right? In other words, like what he wants.
What
U.S. prosperity, right? So the question is it true? This is where the concept of post-neoliberalism, I think, is important, which is to say that the left was so anti-neoliberal that they're shocked when they encounter right-wing anti-neoliberalism, and that's why they have to call it fascism. But they never really dealt with neoliberalism correctly, which is to say they either completely transform their view of capitalism to conform with certain neoliberal policies and ideologies, which distorted the whole idea of capitalism, actually, and lost sight of, you know, so you get this idea that somehow the New Deal is less capitalist than neoliberalism. People forgot some elementary things. So post-neoliberalism means simply that you could have discontents in neoliberalism that both change it, but also further entrench it, right? So post-neoliberalism would be a continuation of neoliberalism and not just a reversal of it. And I think that for someone like Trump, who's just a capitalist opportunist, you know, he's a lot clearer about that than the sort of New Deal people who fool themselves into thinking that somehow they're going to undo neoliberalism and return to the golden age of the 20th century. They're not able to do that. That's really impossible. So all that they could do is bring us a post-neoliberalism, right? But they've, in a sense, blinded themselves with this anti-neoliberalism that makes it appear that the only alternative to neoliberalism is a kind of anti-neoliberalism, as a return to a status quo before neoliberalism. And that's not what's on the agenda. That's not what's possible. And so to get back to the lies about Trump, because of this anti-neoliberalism, people have lost sight of the fact that Trump's a centrist, meaning he's not the extreme right wing of the Republican Party or of American politics in general. He wasn't, you know, for instance, he's not a neoconservative. He's not a neoliberal. He's not a libertarian. He's not a Tea Partier. He's a centrist. He's a centrist who's dealing with the crack up of the consensus, of the centrist consensus. And so that's where we need to think about the direction of capitalism. Now, that's just, you know, capitalism, meaning that, you know, socialists, anyone who wants to be a socialist just has to face reality squarely with sober senses, right? So the thing with the MHI, the Marxist Humanist Initiative, Andrew Kleinman and his cohort, is that they have, you know, blaring across their website with sober senses, but that's precisely what they lost in the face of Trump, right? They don't have a sober approach to what's going on. And probably some similar things would have happened eventually, even if Trump had never been elected president, meaning some kind of reconfiguration of global trade would have been not only possible, but also necessary. I mean, it's funny because the Democrats were the anti-China party for a long time. And so, again, that shift, that kind of hardball kind of perspective on China by Trump would not normally be associated with the Republican Party. That's more of a China, like anti-China Democratic Party thing. So indeed, it's quite possible that the U.S. would have shifted in this way, at least in terms of tweaking the trade relationship between the United States and China under the Democrats.
So I guess to clarify some terms a little bit, I wanted to ask you what your, it's always dangerous to ask anyone to give a positive definition, but what the positive definition for platypus are for you is for neoliberalism, because the way that term is used in general leftist discourse, I often have no idea what people mean by it, unless I'm talking to someone like Philip Murawski, who has a very concrete definition. So what is platypus's understanding of that? Or what is your understanding of that?
Let me use the Adolf Reed formulation, which is, he describes it as a combination of free marketism and upward redistribution. And by the way, we need to understand why upward redistribution happened. In other words, it didn't happen just because rich people got greedy. It happened because of a crisis of profitability in capital that meant that you needed in order for capitalism to be able to rebuild itself and to have the flexibility required to do so, you needed a concentration of capital that could only be achieved through upward redistribution, to use Adolf's phrase. And what he said is that that combination of free marketism and upward redistributionism, that always free marketism was sacrificed. In other words, if one of them had to be sacrificed, it was always the free market that was sacrificed to the upward redistribution imperative. And again, the reason for that was not the greed of the capitalists, but rather the need to have massive amounts of capital be able to be shifted relatively quickly. And financialization is also part of that. So again, there was a crisis of the former system. There was a crisis of the Keynesian Fordist global order that took place in the late 60s and early 70s. And what had been a relatively marginal ideology, namely a kind of ordo-liberalism, neoliberalism, a kind of Hayek Friedman perspective, suddenly found a purchase, suddenly came back in from the wilderness. And it served an ideological function, meaning we didn't get a Friedmanite world. For instance, Friedman wanted to institute a UBI, right? He wanted a free market reform, but he also wanted to institute a UBI. And so we got half of Friedman's program, basically. And that's where David Harvey's concept of neoliberalism as post-Fordism is really apposite. It's really accurate and to the point. So we're in a similar place now, except there doesn't seem to be an ideology ready at hand to justify the necessary changes in the crisis of neoliberalism. So where there was this kind of order liberalism lying around that could be reached to justify the changes in the 70s and 80s, there isn't anything like that now to serve to justify. And I think that that's also what creates the confusion and also the kind of terror around Trump, because it seems to be more temperamentally dispositional. It seems to be about this guy. And, you know, of course, that makes people nervous rather than seeing that he has a more or less ordinary set of assumptions about capitalism, and that this era that we're living through is one of not sweeping ideological change, but of a kind of capitalist muddling through. And in that sense, Trump is entirely appropriate for what's needed. So the sweeping ideology of neoliberalism was never in fact implemented. It was only a rationalization for part of a program. And even the part of the program that was implemented was not implemented consistently and usually had to sacrifice one component to another, namely free marketism was consistently sacrificed to upward redistribution. And politically, of course, neoliberalism never had a free hand, but was always tied to other things that it had nothing to do with, such as neoconservatism. People forget that the neocons and the neoliberals didn't like each other and were opposed to each other in many respects. There are different strands of neoconservatism also to complicate things. And Christian fundamentalism, right? The Reagan coalition was made up of unhappy bedfellows who really had very little to do with each other and didn't agree with each other, but could serve a political role to chart a transformation of capitalism to provide the personnel and the electoral, you know, determinations to allow certain policies to be implemented. And it was always a rickety ride that eventually fell apart under George W. Bush and fell apart under Obama. And so now, of course, American politics and world politics has to reconfigure itself in the face of that. You see the crisis of the EU. And again, if you listen to the neoliberals, right, the crisis of the EU is some kind of atavistic nationalism that's emerging. But no, there's an actual crisis of the EU. In other words, it's not the nationalists are not destroying the EU. The EU is destroying itself. And nationalism is just a symptom of that.
So another question comes to mind that's related to this inability that you see in the contemporary socialistic left. And I have to almost put those in scare quotes from both our
point of view. I'll use a Spartacist term, ostensibly revolutionary organizations, OROs, the orgs, the ostensibly revolutionary organizations, but are they even revolutionary? So now we have not the OROs, the OSOs, the ostensibly socialist organization.
Yeah. So yeah, I actually kind of like that term. So we'll talk about essentially socialist organizations and carry-ons. I think one of your most controversial articles recently was your Death of the Millennial Left article.
Was it controversial?
Well, depends on who you ask.
I hope so.
How do you think the millennial left's relation to Trump and going back to Occupy has to use a crass term, given itself enough rope to only hang itself? I'm going to give you a lot of premises here, so maybe we can be antagonistic later. So what's the relationship exactly between the millennial left and the shift from Obama to Trump?
I've lived through the millennial left's entire life course, if you will, as adults, meaning Platypus started in, 2006, the same year as the new SDS. And we were there for their inaugural convention at the University of Chicago in 2006, the new SDS. And that, of course, was coming out of the Iraq anti-war movement and the crisis of neoconservatism. In other words, if we were to put a name to it, it was the crisis of neoconservatism, meaning neoconservatism had its shot and fucked things up and discredited itself. And, the last couple of years of the George W. Bush administration was characterized by the debacle of neoconservatism. Now, that ended with Obama's election, which was both a victory for the anti-war movement, if you will, because what the anti-war movement wanted was Democrats to come back and save us from the big bad neocons, but also the great crash, the financial downturn 2007-2008. So Obama started out as an anti-war candidate and ended up as the inheritor of the crash and promoting a new New Deal, a Green New Deal. Obama promoted the Green New Deal. But as we know, that was itself controversial. The TARP reforms were controversial. And unfortunately, the right benefited the Tea Party, was the result of discontent with the crash. But it bubbled along, it continued to simmer, and ultimately gave rise to Occupy. And if we recall, the Occupy Wall Street crowd didn't like the anti-war movement. They referred to the anti-war movement as the oldsters. They were very wary of the bad experience and entrenched habits of the anti-war movement, from which they wanted to distinguish themselves. There was a little bit of anarchism versus Marxism to that, a little bit. But also Occupy had a kind of libertarian streak, it was a reflux of the anti-globalization movement of the 90s, and that kind of thing. So I would say that the opportunity for the millennial left was in that combination of the crisis of neoconservatism and the crisis of neoliberalism that you first saw with the Iraq War debacle and then with the crash and the Great Recession. That's the formative moment for the millennial left. And not only those phenomena in society, not only these sort of events that took place, but also a certain disarray in mainstream politics, which was evident, meaning George W. Bush was a very controversial president, even among Republicans. In fact, the neocons were hated by many Republicans. And of course, the TARP reforms that George W. Bush and Obama implemented were controversial among the Republicans. So you get the Tea Party revolt that came out of the Republican Party. The new left, similarly, back in the 60s, had been a product of a crisis of mainstream politics, a crisis of the New Deal coalition. So it's natural for a left to emerge as a result of a crisis in mainstream politics. That's natural. I held out a lot of hope for the millennial left. I was inspired to return to the political public sphere as a result of my students showing certain potential in the early 2000s, early to mid 2000s. And I think that the millennial left missed its opportunity and also learned the wrong lessons. So I think the crisis of neoliberalism is now behind us. And I think that the millennial left, especially as it's been trained by preceding generations of the left, what it inherits, the baggage it inherits from the history of the left, puts it at a disadvantage to deal with new realities. In other words, I think that the kind of opportunism of mainstream politics, these people are not so ideologically burdened. They'll chart a new course, whereas the left makes one particularly hidebound. And so if one has all sorts of blinkers on from the past, one is precisely going to be prevented from seeing the opportunities that are presenting themselves in the present. So in the 90s, I was never an anti-globalization person. I was never an alter globalization person. I was never an anti-Walmart person, right? I thought that one needed to see what opportunities capitalism itself presented for organizing people towards socialism and not just try to resist the next wave of capitalism. Because when capitalism makes a shift, it's very disorganizing and destructive of the political and social status quo. And that's an opportunity. And the point is, you know, a socialist left would have to get out ahead of that, right? Sort of try to anticipate and get out ahead of that process and not lag behind it, especially not lagging behind it by being a conservative force trying to resist it. And that's what the left has been since the 60s. It resisted neoliberalism, and now it's going to try to resist post-neoliberalism, whereas the point is to try to find opportunities in it.
Right. This sort of dovetails with the general platypus line that I actually don't have a problem with here, that the left, on these big deal issues, because mm-hmm. I think there's certainly been progressive turns in other issues, but on mm-hmm. these most like fundamental issues, the left has been in the main reactionary over the last 50 mm-hmm. years, with there are some notable exceptions. But you know, it's not that I find myself completely out of touch with that, but there is a challenge to actually a shared read of the left that we sort of have here, that I was reading your back and forth with Mike McNair of the Communist Party of Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And there's just a couple paragraphs I'd like to read, because I think it's it lays mm-hmm. out the problem pretty gracefully. Let's see. Collective action beyond the most elemental form of the riot requires some degree of permanent collective organization, and organization requires activists. The subjective dynamic, in other words, produces a stratum of activists seeking to defend worker interests and further collectivism. Most obviously, trade union activists and activists of socialist or labor parties, cooperatives, tenants associations, and so on. This stratum includes the mainly ex-student radicals of the organized far left slash left intelligentsia who attempt to involve themselves in the broader workers' movement. It is true that this social stratum is, quote, part of the problem by virtue of the dead-end character of its dominant political commitments, producing repeated diminishing returns, but it is also not capable of being raised to the ground except by actual massacres, because it springs from an objective dynamic of capitalist society. And the stratum is, therefore, also unavoidably part of the solution. The attempt to create a new left by going to fresh forces thus necessarily produces merely another competing splinter group. Since the time of the 1950s, 60s new left, perhaps since the time of the Comintern and its leftist phases, the German March Action, Third Period, and so on, the far left has suffered from a repeated temptation to believe that the membership has failed us. We must elect a new membership in the form of the idea that the social democratic activists or the old left and so on are irredeemable. Hence, the task is to reach out to fresh new forces. Platypus seeks to find these new forces on the university campuses and engages with the rest of the left in order to display to the new forces it attracts that the rest of the left is dead. Just as the Sparts offered extreme requirements of orthodoxy to expose the opportunism of the rest of the left to their new forces. But apart from these particularities, Platypus is like the rest of the far left.
That's fair. Now, Mike's criticism of Platypus was fair. So let me just say about that, that Platypus is not trying to start a new left in the sense of a new party or a new sectarian org, or, you know, a new propaganda group, right? So Platypus has never been a propaganda group. And that's why we've avoided offering analysis, you know, as a tendency. I would say that we've avoided offering analysis. So I've offered more analysis here and in other interviews, like with Doug Lane.
Wouldn't you say there's like a common, I don't know, there's an emergent effect of an organization that has a chief pedagogue, you know, kind of putting their points of view out there? And just as a sort of result of mm-hmm. pluralism and charisma or respect or what have you, that your org does sort of have an unofficial line. Yeah, you don't have like organized factions with different points of view, for instance, to ensure that
program. So we've tried to tread very carefully about this. So what I'd say is this. Okay, so the attitude about the left being dead, as a left, right? And we've also taken some flack on our focus on the left, per se. In other words, on the ideology question, because we don't say, like, you know, you could say in a very different way, however, the workers' movement is dead, socialism is dead, but we say the left is dead as a left, right? And in other words, there's a kind of ideological deadness. There's a kind of dogmatization and thought taboos that's taken hold, especially because we see the left as mostly not really organizing people, but rather just serving an ideological function. So I have another project besides Platypus, and that's the Campaign for a Socialist Party. And that project has a completely different attitude towards the existing left than Platypus does. And that's to treat the existing left as organizers, right? Not as ideologues, but as organizers. And in that respect, of course, one would have to take the existing left seriously, but also take, you know, more broadly, the sort of more colloquial, loose definition of the left, one would have to take the kind of liberal activist, the people who are, you know, around the Democratic Party by default, one would have to take them seriously as an organizational resource. So it's actually not about dismissing all of these people as organizers and as activists. in a, you know, the rebirth of socialism in the United States would have to do something with those people. But we don't want, you know, Platypus, now switching back to Platypus, what Platypus doesn't want is for those people to mislead people at the level of the ideological justifications for what they're doing. So a lot of what the left does in practice is kind of unobjectionable. The problem is its rationale for doing so. And I've mentioned this before, which is to say that using Marxism, kind of abusing Marxism to justify what is essentially liberal activism, I think is a problem, because it really misleads people as to what they think they're doing and what they, what effects they think that they can have. There's a kind of a pessimism involved in the extreme ideological justification for what is very modest kind of liberal social activism. And so I think that that is really an issue that can't be approached head on, at least not in the way that the usual far left groups do. So the usual far left groups try to connect theory and practice in a certain way. And Platypus is born of the idea that actually that usual way of doing things doesn't work. And so, in fact, there would need to be a more bifurcated approach, a division of labor between the ideological problem and the practical political problem. And in the practical political domain, I think that I completely agree with Mike there, that things like ideological litmus tests and theoretical agreement are really poisonous and really noxious. And so that requires a completely different approach. And so there's a way in which Platypus embraces the extreme kind of ideological rigidity of the left in order to kind of break it in its brittleness.
You're hypertrophying towards transcendence.
Hopefully, or at least to expose it, right? To expose it, you know, to make it palpable, right? To expose its false, like, you know, the ISO, for example, seems very reasonable, right? They have a certain art in the way that they use Marxism to justify liberal activism. And it's actually a kind of highly ideologically rigidified phenomenon that appears to be very supple and elastic and flexible and reasonable. And that's pernicious. And it actually goes back to Stalinism, that this is something that one first saw in the 1930s. So there's that problem, right? Which is that, look, this isn't Marxism. And maybe that doesn't matter, right? In other words, the ISO should just be a liberal activist group and not call itself Marxist or Trotskyist or whatever it calls itself, Leninist. It shouldn't reach for Lenin and Luxembourg to justify what it's doing, because not necessary, really. But also, they're not organizing the new socialist movement that we need, right? So, but neither is liberalism going to spontaneously become socialism either. So, facing that problem, it requires a multifarious approach. You need a multiple approach. It's not like one organization and one approach is going to do the trick in working through this problematic historical legacy. So there's a problem in practice and there's a problem in theory, if you will, and Platypus very deliberately restricted itself. So that's why we don't have political debates. Like we don't host fora in which people will hash out programmatic disputes, but rather it's about what people think, right? And it's not debates, it's conversations. In other words, well, what do you think? And there was a moment when it seemed like that was possible, when people were willing to set aside their preconceptions. And that was, again, the anti-war movement, the new SDS. The older 60s veterans who were mentoring the new SDS, they said very explicitly, look, don't repeat us. Don't make our mistakes. And a lot of what we believed may or may not have turned out to have been true, and you guys should not take it unquestioningly. In other words, there was a moment when actually when Platypus said the left is dead, it wasn't as polemical and condemnatory. It wasn't taken to be that in the way that it came to be subsequently. There was a kind of optimistic moment, you know, 12 or 13 years ago, in which people would say, yeah, you're right, the left is dead, and we got to rethink things. As that moment passed, then, of course, people became less open to that kind of questioning. They retreated back into their certitudes, and they started to take offense at the gesture, right? So that's, you know, but again, like the campaign for a socialist party isn't premised on the left is dead kind of approach, because it's not really about like, it's only about the left in a very broad sense. It's not like about the hard left. It's more about a kind of liberal activism that is being maneuvered now by the Democratic Party. I mean, I guess the DSA is ultimately going to square that circle and get all the socialists to sign on for progressive liberalism in the end, you know, but there seemed to have been a moment a few years ago, really before the Sanders candidacy, where it appeared that the experience of the millennial left up to that point had exhausted a kind of liberal activist base, right, and that therefore you could engage those people and say socialism, right? So it's never been about, you know, dismissing people, right? Like, that's the way it's taken to be, because, you know, this is the left's own modus operandi. So they just treated platypus like it was a species of itself. But we were very aware of the pitfalls of just becoming another org.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's episode. Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives are produced for Zero Books by the team of C. Derek Varn, J.G. Michael, Amog Sahu, and Toby Kamir, our ever faithful producer and editor. Please keep following us on the Inside Zero Books Patreon account for additional episodes. Have a good day.